First case on our calendar is 08873 in the matter of complaint of communication options, Inc. with Valtech Communications. Mr. Elliott.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if I may. Very briefly, Your Honors, this case arises out of a dispute between two local exchange carriers, Valtech Communications and a company known as COI. Valtech's owner had been the largest creditor of COI in a bankruptcy proceeding, and by 2004, several sales reps from COI had left during the bankruptcy process to join Valtech. 2004, Valtech launched a better price, better service marketing campaign that eventually attracted about 4,000 new customers, 388 of which were former customers of COI. This case involves five of those customers, or less than a tenth of a percent of the customers that were sold by Valtech. The PUCO held a hearing in this dispute in October 2005, and about a year later issued a decision holding that Valtech had misled these five customers into switching their services from COI to Valtech. We would submit that there were several legal errors committed throughout the process, any one of which would have warranted reversal of the entire outcome of this case. And let me
Let me start with a threshold question. Why does not the FCC have jurisdiction, exclusive jurisdiction over this matter?
Well, that's a good question, Your Honor. I think that dovetails into our first proposition of law. We believe that this case never should have gone beyond the motion to dismiss stage. It's very clear in the Ohio Administrative Code that when a carrier learns of an unauthorized change, they are to follow the FCC rules for the complaint resolution process. The FCC rules for the complaint resolution process require that the carrier direct the customer to the Public Utilities Commission and or the unauthorized carrier for resolution of that complaint. And if and only if the informal complaint procedures fail, is the subscriber, the customer, entitled to bring a claim before the Public Utilities Commission. None of that occurred here. Not one of these five customers was directed to the PUCO for resolution of the complaint. Not one of these five customers made a complaint with the Public Utilities Commission. This was completely a complaint that was derived by a competitor that was attempting to thwart the process of another competitor launching a successful marketing campaign. So we believe, Your Honor, that this should never have gone beyond the motion to dismiss stage and should have been tossed at the beginning of the case. There were other legal errors, Your Honor, as throughout the process that followed. And if I could just go to Proposition of Law 3 very quickly, because it really kind of follows better in order, and that is the motion to separate the witnesses at the outset of the proceeding. Again, we don't even think a hearing should have occurred, but assuming it did occur, this entire hearing turned on the testimony of these five witnesses. These were five customers that were attempting to recall what had been said in a sales pitch a year and a half earlier. Five customers. And we made a motion to separate the witnesses at the outset of the proceeding. Hearing examiner denied our motion. We renewed the objection again in opening statement. Nonetheless, all five of these witnesses sat in this hearing and listened to the statements of counsel about what the case was going to show and listened to the testimony of the other witnesses. And if you look at the record, Your Honors, each of these witnesses had a very difficult time recalling what had been said in a sales pitch a year and a half earlier. And it is beyond me why in the world these witnesses weren't, you know, excluded from the hearing room, sat outside. There was absolutely no justification for not sitting them out there. The Ohio Revised Code clearly provides that the rules of evidence apply to a 4905 proceeding, which is what this was.
Is that a structural error?
I believe it is. I believe it's an error that poisoned the entire process, Your Honor.
What do you do about an error like that?
Boy, I think that error mandates reversal, because now that these witnesses have all sat into the hearing and listened to the testimony of everybody else, I think it's impossible to put that genie back in the bottle. That's one of the arguments that the my opponent raised is that we didn't renew this objection at each witness that was called in the PUCO hearing. Well, I would submit to the court that the bottom line is that once one of these witnesses testified and once counsel's statement were heard by all five of these witnesses, a genie was out of the bottle, and it's very, you know, difficult to replace that. So I believe, as I mentioned earlier, that that merits reversal of the case for the commission's error.
If there is sufficient evidence beyond the testimony of those witnesses, it should not should have been sequestered. Certainly, it appears that magistrate was wrong. Is that not prejudicial error on her part?
It is prejudicial error on her part, and the only evidence to support these claims of misrepresentation was the testimony, the recollection of these witnesses. We had a number of witnesses that testified on Valtech's behalf that denied making the statements of any kind, and I'd tell the court that there was all kinds of opportunity for confusion here because Valtech's owner had been the largest creditor of COI in a bankruptcy proceeding. Valtech sales reps had formerly been employed with COI and sold COI services. So when statements were made about COI being in the bankruptcy process and what Valtech was, there was ample opportunity for confusion and made it even more important that these witnesses were separated before the trial. I would also submit, Your Honors, that we have two propositions of law, they are 2 and 4, that relate to the slamming violation. They're separate and distinct propositions.
Before you go there, I'd like to get back to the jurisdictional question. You've claimed as a jurisdictional defect that they didn't file their complaint or try to informally resolve first. But you are actually challenging how the PUCO was processing this. And that challenge seems, under the FTC rules, to belong in the federal reign, not in the state reign. When you're challenging the process, and they're not challenging the factual determination, but the process. What is your response to that?
Well, I would agree with you there, but I think there are two distinct issues. There's certainly an FCC rule at play here, but there is also the Ohio Administrative Code provision that makes clear that a formal complaint may be filed after the informal complaint resolution process is followed. And here's why that's so important. In this particular case, if the customers, again, not one of them who approached the PUCO or was directed to the PUCO, had gone there and said, we have been told that misrepresentations were made. This complaint was filed in May of 2004. These misrepresentations allegedly were made in March 2004. That would have given Valtech the opportunity to come forward to meet with the PUCO and these customers and clear up the confusion and resolve these complaints. This process never would have even moved forward. So, Justice Stratton, I understand your question. I think the FCC issue is a fair one, but I also think that under the Ohio Administrative Code, you are not permitted to file a complaint until this informal process is followed, and I think it's a critically important process to follow, and it wasn't followed here. My propositions of law 2 and 4 relate to the slamming violation that was alleged in COI's complaint. That is the only claim that was made in this case, that these customers were slammed. And Your Honors, I would indicate that the slamming violation relates to whether or not any of these customers were changed without authorization. In this particular case, every single one of those five customers was presented with a letter of agency, an LOA, signed the letter of agency that indicated that they were switching their service from COI to Valtech. There was no dispute that they understood that they were switching their service and that they signed these LOAs. Where things became a little dicey is that the hearing examiner permitted COI to pursue a claim of misrepresentation. In other words, okay, the LOAs were signed and presented, but were there misrepresentations behind the LOAs that caused these customers to sign them? I would submit, Your Honors, that number one, there was no such claim ever asserted in the complaint, even though COI submitted an original complaint and an amended complaint. But more importantly, I would submit that the reason COI did not file such a claim is because COI wouldn't have had standing to assert a misrepresentation claim that had been made to third parties that were totally unrelated to COI. So in essence, what happened is we proceeded with a claim at trial that was not asserted in the complaint, and based on misrepresentations made to third parties that were not parties in the proceeding. And Your Honors, when we get to the slamming violation, the hearing examiner at trial did not apply the proper standard. The hearing examiner, if you look at the decision, makes clear she did not apply the clear and convincing standard to a claim of misrepresentation. Even if that claim were allowed to proceed, she needed to apply the proper standard to that claim, and she did not. In fact, she shifted the burden to Valtech and indicated that Valtech had the burden to show that these misrepresentations were not made by clear and convincing evidence. That turns burden of proof completely on its head in the state of Ohio. And why is that important? It's important because if you look at the testimony of every single one of these customers, one of the customers, Ivan Maybach, testified that he didn't rely on any misrepresentation, that he was going to go, the sales rep that came to him was the same sales rep he had at COI, and he was going to follow that sales rep no matter what was said. Another, Kelly Ward, did not identify any misrepresentations. A third, Peggy Correll, was not even part, she's the one that signed the LOA on behalf of her business, was not even part of the sales pitch. She didn't even hear any of the statements that had been made to her husband. And the other two, Cornell Webb and Harold Tomes, were so vague in their recollections that there's just simply no way that we can say that their testimony meets the clear and convincing standard. And finally, Your Honors, our final proposition of law relates to the fine that was imposed. The hearing examiner imposed a fine of $25,000, which has been taken, by the way, to the Richland County Court of Common Pleas in a civil action filed by COI alleging the exact same things, which is where this case should have been in the first place. Summary judgment was obtained based on the PUCO decision and has led to a treble damages judgment. That's why this is so important. The fine that was imposed for every single one of those customers. And I would submit that several of the customers didn't identify any misrepresentations, and again, the clear and convincing standard was not met with the others. So we would submit that the entire decision of the PUCO should be reversed and vacated. If there are any other questions, Your Honor, I'm finished and ready to pass the table to my opponent. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Elliott. Mr. Jones.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, my name is John Jones. I have with me co-counsel Bill Wright on behalf of the Public Utilities Commission of Ohio. In order to have a valid authorized carrier change for a consumer's provider of telephone service, two requirements must be met. The first requirement is that a carrier must obtain the consent of the consumer. And number two, that consent must be verified in accordance with the rules of the Federal Communications Commission. If you don't have one of those requirements, you have slamming. In this case, Valtech didn't satisfy both requirements, and it was the finding of the commission, and that the letters of agency forms that were used here by Valtech to switch service of these five consumers, they did not comply with the federal rules. And this was a finding by the commission that they did not comply with the federal rules and therefore were invalid. And that is a finding by the commission that's not being challenged here by Valtech. And that is sufficient, competent, credible evidence to prove slamming.
What was missing? What was missing in the form?
Well, Your Honor, the form requires particular information to be included. It should be an all-inclusive form. And Valtech had modified that form, added attachments to that form. And the whole purpose with the federal rule, Your Honor, in regards to letters of agency, they want to make it simple and clear so that there's no confusion. But that form was not the form that was provided to these consumers, and it created confusion. And for instance, Kelly Ward.
What was missing?
Well, Your Honor, like on one of the on the forms, one of them didn't have the authorized subscriber signing one of the forms. Another one, it didn't have the authorized business address provided. I believe another one didn't have the signature of the subscriber, and didn't provide any information about any switching fees being included for switching service providers. And it had attachments as to where signatures would be obtained. These are all things that you know, that are that violate the federal rules as to what's required. Like I said, it has to be an all-inclusive document, and it's made so it's it eliminates any ambiguity, so it's clear as to what consumers are being asked to do and what
so
to consider.
So the business address was missing on one. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And what was it?
Another one didn't have the actual subscriber, the authorized subscriber for the service.
Somebody else signed it.
Someone else signed it. And another one, the forms also didn't provide information as to any switching fees being involved.
And they were how much?
I don't know, Your Honor. It's not in the record as to what the switching fees would have been for the switch of these five consumers. And also, I believe the information contained credit information of the consumers, which is not to be included in these particular forms, and that information was included. So you had a lot of additional information being incorporated into these forms that the federal rules don't allow. And like I said, that creates a lot of confusion, and obviously it created confusion in this case. And for instance,
I'm not understanding that, but go on. Tell us why it's all right to leave when this is a very fact-driven hearing, why it's all right to leave the other four people who haven't yet testified in the room to hear what the first one said about the call. How is that not prejudicial?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, Your Honor, in this case, the attorney examiner admonished those witnesses at the time that motion was made and made clear to them that their testimony should be limited to their interactions, to their experiences with these Valtech sales agents, and not to be influenced by other witnesses' testimony. And that was followed in this case, Your Honor, because
That doesn't seem very helpful.
Well, Your Honor, we had five different accounts here, five different stories as to what occurred in these representations. And each one of those were dealt with five different sales agents, five different consumers, five different places, five different times, five different tactics.
If you had to do over again, what would you tell a hearing examiner to do on that question?
Well, Your Honor, you know, the commission has broad discretion in the conduct of its hearings. I mean, you know, that was a call made by that attorney examiner. There's no prejudice shown. There's nothing in the record that shows that someone's testimony was tainted by another witness's testimony. That, you know, this court has previously acknowledged that administrative agencies are not bound by the strict rules of evidence. There's no showing here.
So you'd tell them to do it the same way again?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You would tell them to do it the same way again?
That would not be my preference, Your Honor.
That was my question. Yeah.
But I mean, again, what has to be shown here is prejudice. And, you know, even in a court of law, Your Honor, evidence rule 615, you know, the general courts division, the trial judges have discretion as to, you know, witnesses remaining in the room, a party or an officer or an employee or a person, you know, that's helped to establish their cause. So, I mean, it's not a hard, strict rule to begin with. There is discretion by judges, even in the common pleas division. But here there's no prejudice being shown, Your Honor, for any witness's testimony being tainted by another witness's testimony.
Mr. Jones, if we put aside for a moment the witness's testimony, is it your position that the forms themselves are so technically deficient that is enough to prove the slamming violation?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, you only have to show that the forms were not in compliance to show slamming, and that was done in this case. So independent of any testimony given in this case, the forms were deficient.
They were
held to be invalid, and there's no substantial compliance here.
But the commission went further and took the testimony regarding misrepresentations and so on.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you're saying that even if we separated that out, the technical violations are enough?
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah, the fact that the forms, they did not follow the federal rules in terms of what was needed to be contained within that document for those forms to be valid. There was slamming proven in this case. Okay. And the federal
also,
rules.
What about the federal rule that states that COI was to inform the subscriber of their right to complain, and then the consumer be the engine for the complaint as opposed to COI?
Yes, Your Honor. As to that provision, the commission, using its expertise, interpreted its rules in the federal rules and determined that the referral of complaint provision had no application in the situation. Now, this is a situation where the subscribers didn't approach any carriers to complain about the switching and going on in their service. What happened here is that Communications Options were getting these forms showing that all these customers were wanting to change their service, and all of a sudden it was just like an avalanche of these forms coming in, and they're seeing the signatures of agents that used to be agents for them. And so, of course, then they started their own investigation and started contacting these customers saying, well, what's going on here, you know? And so it was them initiating this whole process, and then, of course, Communications Options bringing that complaint. So the referral.
But that's not what the statute outlines as the procedure.
Your Honor, that referral of complaint provision says that if a carrier is informed by a subscriber of a complaint of not having giving authorization for a switch of their provider, then they shall refer them either to the state commission or to the federal commission or to the alleged unauthorized carrier or to themselves to resolve that complaint. But here in this situation, there was no information coming to the carrier, Communications Options. It was Communications Options initiating this by contacting those consumers to try to find out what was going on here. And that's when it was learned that there were, these forms were being used and these representations were being made. So that provision didn't have any application, the referral of a complaint, because, first of all, there is no duty on a subscriber to even go to a carrier. They can come directly to the commission. If you look at that rule, it doesn't say, subscriber, you shall go to the carrier, who then the carrier shall tell the subscriber to go to the commission or go to the alleged unauthorized carrier. That's not there. So, I mean, there's no requirement for that. And for any case coming before the commission, bringing a complaint under 4905.26, no one has to go through an informal complaint process if you have a complaint for your electric service or your bill or gas or another utility. That's just not a requirement that's required here.
But Mr. Jones, who are the slamming rules designed to protect?
Yes, Your Honor.
Who?
The slamming rules are designed to protect the consumers, Your Honor.
And here the consumers did not bring the complaint.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So in a sense, aren't you saying that it's not only for the protection of the consumers, but you would want us to suggest that the company with whom the consumers originally have their service are also, those companies are also to be protected? I mean, isn't that what you're saying? If we're allowing COI to be the engine that drives this action?
Yes, Your Honor. Under 4905.73, it provides for a person to bring a complaint for slamming in person. If you look under 4905.02, it defines person to include utility, and that's where we fall in. That's where Communications Options falls into play here. And if you notice under 4905.73, C2 and C3, it also provides for making the utility whole. The authorized carrier whole as to any compensation that needs to be to make them whole for losing those customers. So yes, they can bring it on behalf of those their customers. They're the authorized carrier, and Valtech is the unauthorized carrier. So they have a direct and real interest here as a party to this action on behalf of their customers and on behalf of themselves in losing that business. So yes, they are a proper party to bring that action.
Counsel, I have a question about the penalty involved in the two issues here. If we were to determine that the request to change service on the was invalid because of the forms, and that part of the commission's finding was correct, but the testimony was tainted, so that could not be considered. Does that change the result in terms of what kind of penalties the commission is authorized to assess in this case?
No, Your Honor. No, it doesn't. I mean, it shows a pattern of these defective forms being used in five different occasions, and there's being supporting five different incidents of slamming. And under 4905.73, of course, there's a wide latitude being given from the legislature to the commission to make that determination, to make that judgment as to when slamming shows that there's a pattern of slamming occurring. And based on those defective forms being used multiple times, and they were defective in many, many ways, that was sufficient to show slamming and a pattern of slamming. It was systematic. It was systematic in the sense of it creating confusion for all these consumers as to what, you know, what they were being asked to do, and not being clear and unambiguous as the federal rules would require. And so based on that wide latitude given to the commission and given the facts of our case, the commission decided that it was its judgment that there was a pattern established here, and then escalated that penalty as to $5,000 per incident for five incidents, and being $25,000. And say that that was reasonable and lawful. And I would ask this court to affirm the judgment.
I have a question before you sit down, counsel. Yes, you haven't spoken to the jurisdictional issue. It seems to me, as I read the federal law, that when one challenges the process by which the commission determines slamming issues, the process, not whether they're slamming, but the process that the commission uses, that there's an appeal to the FCC, not to this court. What is your response?
Well, Your Honor, first of all, there is an election that could be made, and you can go to the state commission or to the federal commission. And when you elect to go to the state commission, then this court would have jurisdiction as to an appeal from the commission's decision on that finding of slamming for that particular case. And so
even if it challenges the process.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. Again, these are rules that were adopted by the commission.
Okay, what's the strongest federal authority for that?
I'm sorry.
What's your strongest federal authority for that proposition?
Federal authority?
Yes.
Well, just the fact that...
This is a system under which the federal government has said to the states, you can decide these cases, these slamming issues, but under certain conditions. And as you know, the states, the General Assembly adopted legislation to track the federal statute and so forth. But there's this provision, it seems to me, the argument, well, you haven't argued it, but it seems to me there's an argument that if the challenge is to, under federal law, if the challenge is to the process by which the state commission decides the substantive issues, the factual issues, that the question of process goes to the FCC. That's not your reading of the law, I take it.
No, Your Honor. Okay. And that's not an error that's raised by Valtech here.
My next question was going to be whether we should ask for supplemental briefing. We don't want to decide a case here over which we don't have jurisdiction. That's my point.
Yes, Your Honor.
I want to be sure that we have jurisdiction to decide the merits of the case.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, the commission made that factual determination based on a review of those forms that they didn't comply with the federal rules, that the commission adopted those federal rules, and the state rules follow the federal rules. And for that reason, this court would have jurisdiction to review that matter. And I'd ask this court to affirm the commission's decision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Mr. Elliott, you've saved almost 3 minutes of your time.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Let me deal with that question first, because I think certainly the FCC process is in play, but nobody's disputing that the FCC rules require a carrier to refer the subscriber on to the PUCO. What we are disputing is that the Ohio Administrative Code makes clear that one can file a formal complaint if the informal resolution process does not work, which did not occur here. And Justice O'Connor, I wanted to immediately address the issue you raised. If you look at COI's amended complaint, they say with respect to every single customer that the customer was referred by COI to the PUCO for resolution of its complaint. That did not occur with any one of the five customers, and that's a recognition by COI that they had the obligation to do that. COI at trial presented a letter that was written in August of 2004 that was sent to subscribers. There was no evidence that it was sent to these five customers, and it was 4 months after the complaint was filed.
Counsel, I gathered from opposing counsel's response to my question is that when the complaint is consumer-driven and the former carrier is notified, then the statute takes effect and there is that directive to try and resolve it informally, and if not, then the consumer becomes the complainant. But he said because this is something that came to their attention outside of a consumer complaining about the switch, in other words, they were deluged by paper indicators of the switch, that they're not bound by that statute, that course of events that have to take place. They can become the complainant outside of the process that's outlined in the statute.
Well, there's no support for that in the statute whatsoever, but more importantly, they did learn about these misrepresentations from the customers themselves. Once they learn of those misrepresentations, that's when they need to direct these customers to the PUCO for resolution of the complaint. COI has a tortious interference complaint in the Richland County Court of Common Pleas. That's where that belongs. If these customers had complaints, they needed to be referred on to the commission.
That was going to be my question, is what is their recourse if they cannot become a complainant with the PUCO of the business practices of your client?
Right. And I would submit, Your Honor, it's very dangerous to have competitors litigating these issues in the administrative setting, to go out and round up customers to try to thwart the competition that was going on. If they have a valid claim, let them assert that claim in the Common Pleas Court, not in the administrative proceeding. And I wanted to very briefly address the defect to the LOAs. It was nothing more than disclosing whether there were any fees charged with the switch. There were not. And the remedy, Justice Kupp, is to fix the LOA, which Valtech did. I would submit, Your Honors, that, again, it is very dangerous to have competitions thwarted like this. The PUCO can simply not get away with not following the informal complaint process, not separating witnesses, not applying the proper...
You need to sum up, Mr. Elliott.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.